So we're going to go ahead and we're going to get started. So welcome, welcome. I'm Marie Harvey, Associate Dean for Research, and I'm glad to see all of you here. And I'm going to turn this over to the panel, have them introduce themselves. What they're going to do after they introduce themselves, they will each take a say about, I'm thinking, 7 minutes or so, and we'll make sure we don't get too long. To just firstly talk about why is it important to publish your research findings, and then from their perspective or their discipline, what are some of the tips to help you do to be a successful publisher in your area? So, and then we're going to open it for questions. So we'll have about 40 to 45 minutes for you just to ask questions. And because we're recording this, the faculty will probably repeat your question after you ask it, or speak loudly because we have, you can get it picked up in some of the speakers up above there. Okay. All right. Let's get started. I'll let the panel introduce themselves.
Well, welcome everyone. Thank you for coming. My name is Megan McDonald, and I'm an associate professor of kinesiology here in our college.
My name is John Geldof. I'm an associate professor in human development and family studies, or sciences, depending on who you are. And I edit the Journal of Applied Developmental Science.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Sunil Khanna, and I'm a professor in the Global Health Program. And I also serve as the editor-in-chief of Ecology of Food and Nutrition.
Cool. My name is Zhang Huiyun. I'm a faculty health management and policy.
And my name is Molly Kyle. I'm an associate professor here in the college in the Environmental and Occupational Health Unit. And I have served, I gave them up, on editorial boards in journals in environmental health. Okay. And we've decided we're going to run this like an improv panel to try to reduce. I'm letting everybody know. So each one of us is going to and onto the other one instead of and keep this going. So we were, as a panel, posed 4 different questions and kind of asked to develop our responses. So I'm just going to start with the first question. Okay. So the first one was, why is it important to publish? That's actually a question that I've gotten a couple times from students. And I have kind of 2 things I want to say with this. And starting off, how many of you heard the adage, publish or perish? Most of you. What do you think that actually means? Anybody have an idea? Anybody want to venture a guess?
If you want a chance to get a promotion or opportunity to.
So if you want to have a chance at getting a promotion, that's absolutely part of it. You had your hand up.
I suppose that is.
This is the improv part. And.
It's important that our CV is stacked so that we have a good reputation, and one way to represent yourself is through publications.
Yeah, so it's definitely CV food. It demonstrates your expertise in a field. It contributes to your qualifications. Yeah, beer.
If you don't publish your research, then probably someone will be doing the similar research and they will publish before you. And like everyone wants to do that. Like they want to, someone who's doing research, they always are striving for new knowledge. And if you are generating new knowledge, you need to publish that.
So if you don't publish it, somebody else will, and you'll get scooped because the goal of the game is new research. And that is the perfect segue, because a lot of people do think of it as a self-reflection kind of thing. But in my opinion, what that adage really means is that information is not, if that that information that you've gathered, whatever that is, that it's not, if it's if it isn't properly documented through a rigorous peer review process, the information itself perishes and you perish with it. Because really, the goal of the research is, if you can't get your work to pass rigorous peer review, then you really don't have much of a future as a research career. So it's really about the ability to preserve knowledge in a shareable, searchable way. To me, that's what it really kind of boils down to, which is that second part. Information, in order to become permanent part of the record, it needs to be shareable. It needs to be able to be put out in the world where it's scrutinized, discussed, disseminated, and put into practice. And that's the publication process. So there's a lot of different ways that you can publish knowledge: books, peer reviews, manuscripts, white papers, blogs, videos, what we're doing here today and talking. Each of those will be shareable, scrutinizable, and everything else. But if you've gone through a peer review process, that's kind of the highest quality of review. So to me, that's where it is. And if your job requires research, you really do need to prioritize peer review publication, because yes, that's what your funders want. That's how the information gets out there. And yes, it does help serve your own career as well. And this kind of gets back to, and I'm getting a little philosophical here, but the minute you kind of put a big part of your publication process is the method you applied to get that information. By sharing that in such detail that another researcher can reproduce it, that's the scientific theory. That goes back to how we got out of the Renaissance. You know, like this is Thomas Aquinas and Sir Francis Bacon. That's why we publish. And your career, if you can do that, should flourish. And.
There's no end here. It's end of story. Seriously, so why do you have to publish?
Mm-hmm.
To let your work known to your audience. So I do policy research, health policy research, and ultimate goal of my work, you know, personally, is to institute the policy, you know, based on evidence we are finding. And obviously the very starting point is to ask the right questions that if evidence found, that might kind of contribute to improvement of well-being for target population that I really care about. So whatever I do personally, I'm always thinking the ultimate goal of my research. So let the world know that, you know, this is the finding, you know, most recent finding based on the most cutting edge research. So especially for the audience, not, you know, lay audience, they're not, you know, someone, because they are lay audience, they're not someone kind of stupid. They are very highly educated, you know, policymakers who making laws every day. So to influence, you know, certain policy in such a way that, you know, we as a society achieve common welfare, that's, you know, always what I'm thinking is my ultimate goal. So again, a little bit repetitive, the ultimate goal is to gonna give data that those policymakers can use to make, you know, changes to policy to better the society. So if we don't, we're just not doing that, right? So.
And.
And, I mean, how do you add and to that inspiring, you know, statement and what Molly just very nicely grounded as to, you know, why publish? In terms of, you know, this whole old saying, publish or perish. And I've been, to tell you the truth, just to get ready for this panel, I've been kind of reading some of the stuff that's available online. And there are peer-reviewed articles written on graduate student publications. So I read some of those just to impress all of you here. And it was interesting that now, instead of saying publish or perish, which has a little bit of a negative connotation there, the phrase that people are using is publish and progress. Mm-hmm. So that says publish and professionally grow, those kinds of things. So I'm assuming that all of you are here in the academy and you have your own life's goals or you have own academic goals. And one of the ways in which you could become part of the academy is to publish. And publication, as Molly pointed out so nicely, is one of the best mechanisms for you to share your knowledge with the larger academic community. So, I mean, there are many other ways to do that, but probably that is considered to be the so-called hallmark or signature or the best practice ways of sharing your knowledge in the academic community. And Django pointed out that, you know, there is a very utilitarian dimension to your publication that you all should never underestimate, that what you are publishing could eventually be used by people, not just within the academy to publish more papers, but actually take the information that you have generated and apply it in a policy context or in an implementation context. So that brings me to a little bit of my work that I do. I work in community-based settings, and most of my work is done in collaboration with non-government organizations or NGOs who have people who are committed to the cause of bringing change, but they don't have, often they don't have the larger context to fully appreciate the work that they are doing. And at times that collaborative relationship gets strengthened when I can point them to some of the published articles on the very work that they are doing or some of the designs that they are using without realizing the context in which those designs are embedded. Sometimes that helps them do a better job. Sometimes that helps them save on in terms of time and resources, and sometimes they serve as best practice reminders for that. So there is that dimension to, you know, publication. I also think that by publishing, and it brings me back to that old philosophical way of thinking how knowledge grows. Thomas Kuhn, this very famous philosopher, talked about, you know, the structure of scientific revolution, and his entire PhD thesis was eventually turned into this book called The Structure of Scientific Revolution. So if you get an opportunity to read that, it's a very interesting book where he talks about how ideas spin off of each other and then grow into bigger or more complicated ideas. So the idea of thesis, which is just simply an idea, and then antithesis, which is an opposite of that, will eventually lead to synthesis, which is the development of a more complicated idea. And that synthesis then becomes thesis for a future idea, antithesis, synthesis. So we grow knowledge in this very triangular way. So that's another reason that you really want to contribute to the existing body of knowledge. And what you bring, one of the ways for you to know how important that is to put it through the so-called filter of publication or the peer-reviewed process. And I hope that at some point in our panel, we will talk about what is a peer-review process. So maybe we are assuming that all of us know what a peer-review process is, but it has many forms and manifestations. So hopefully we'll get to that. And finally, I just want to point out that going through the peer review process or going through the process of publishing your ideas can be very inspiring. If you have a little bit of a thick skin, you know, it can be very inspiring. It can be demoralizing. Yes, I agree with that. But once you see your product in print in front of you or online, it tends to have a snowball effect on your career and also on your commitment to the work that you're doing. Okay, so I'll stop at this point and hand it over.
And so just to get a sense for where we're all heading, can I get a quick show of hands? How many of you actually want to progress into a research-based career as of right now? Okay, and how many of you want to be more practitioners or some sort of career that doesn't involve basically having research as a huge component of your job? And how many of you don't know? That's good. That's okay. That's what students are supposed to be doing, right? Figuring things out. So I'm going to try to give less of a philosophical why should we publish and talk more about why should you publish from a very pragmatic utilitarian perspective. And of course, the end result is always it helps you get a job. Whether you want to go into research or you don't want to go into research, having a good CV opens doors. And why is that? Well, one, it shows your potential for impact. If you're doing a good job, if you're publishing now, you're likely to continue having a good, solid impact on whatever your field of choice is, either as a practitioner or as a researcher. Importantly for universities especially, it suggests your ability to later attract money. Research institutions love overhead. It's good for us. It helps us thrive. And so if there are indicators that you will actually be a successful and well-funded researcher, you're going to rise to the top of who do we want to hire? Because you're going to make contributions back to the university as well as contributions to society. Third, it shows that you're knowledgeable. Now, anybody who's gotten to a master's degree probably has a decent in-depth knowledge of fields writ large, broadly. But to publish means that you are establishing an identity, you are becoming an expert in something. And to show that expertise is invaluable because now you have something very specific that you bring to the table that nobody else does. And that takes me to the final point I want to say is we're not training you to be TAs. We're not training you to be research assistants. What we're really training all of you to be is entrepreneurs, right? You need to be able to be R&D. You need to be sales. You need to be marketing, all of that for yourself. And publishing helps you develop those specific skills that are important for people in academe and for people not in academe. You need to learn how to write a compelling argument. You need to be able to think of critical ideas and test those ideas in a very thorough and methodical way. Doesn't matter where you end up, showing people that you can do those things, showing people that you can sell your ideas in a way that's convincing, that gets you a job. So publishing is also a conduit by which you develop these skills and you convey to your future employers that, yes, I have these skills and I will bring these skills to you. And?
So I have nothing to add. No, I'm just kidding. All of my co-panelists have certainly covered a lot, and I echo what they're all saying. I think I have two key points to add. The work that I do is in adapted physical activity and primarily around people and primarily around children with disabilities. In addition to contributing to the broader field of science, in my field, I really feel like I'm making a difference for people with the work that we're publishing. And to extend on what Jang Ho said, you never know where your research is going to end up. And I do have a recent story. It's actually not my story. It belongs to one of my former graduate students. Her name's Erica Twardzik. She's currently doing her PhD at another institution. And her work was actually focused on data from the state of Oregon, the Oregon Department of Education, and she took a look at what happens to kids with developmental delays after the age of 5. And in the state of Oregon, if you had a developmental delay and it was only labeled a developmental delay after the age of 5, you lost access to special education services. And at a federal level, you're actually eligible for services up to age 9, but different states have different regulations. And there were over a year ago, there was testimony at the State Department that was really advocating to change this in the state of Oregon. And while Erica's piece was just one part of that testimony, ultimately the data that she collected and the research that she did showed that we were better off to sort of serve children even if they had a delay after the age of 5. And I'm happy to say that July 1st of this year, that law went into effect in the state of Oregon. So I think that also our work really has the potential to have an impact on people. I also, my other and, I have a long list, but it's been covered. my other and is, I think echoing some of what Sunil was talking about with ideas that ultimately kind of spin off of each other and the work that's been done before us. And I have a current graduate student who's doing work specifically around student athletes with disabilities. And actually what she's using as a reference right now is work that was done around Title IX. So for those of you that don't know, Title IX of the Education Amendments Act of 1972 is a federal law that states no person in the United States shall on the basis of sex be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. And the work and research that has ultimately been published since Title IX is informing new work that she's doing now. So while they're very different, that's the theoretical perspective that she's come out. So I also believe that that has real potential to impact people. You want to go? Oh, I get to start. Okay. All right. So that was the five of us answering the first part of this question, which was why it's important to publish your research findings. And the second part is tips on how to publish successfully. This is a fun one to start with. So I have a number of tips. And when I was sort of planning for this, I was thinking of my own tips. They were good reminders to myself. But I was also sort of going back to where I was when I was in graduate school and thinking about what was helpful for me when I was thinking about publishing. And so some of these you're already going to know, but I'm going to echo them. So first of all, you actually have to do the work. Yeah. So that's number one. And I always say something on the page is better than nothing. And I know that might sound really silly, but I have all kinds of ideas going on in my head about new research projects and papers that I want to write. But until I actually get it on paper, that's where it lives. And that's also where sometimes I forget about it, where it goes away. So it's really important to do the work, to sit down, make the time, and to get information on paper. So another one, for those of you that may be procrastinators, sometimes like myself, this is a spoiler alert. Sometimes we don't like to pass it on until it's perfect. We all want our writing to be perfect, and it's not. And so that's also something that I think that we need to work on, is being able to sort of move forward with some of what we're doing and being okay with those imperfections. And oftentimes getting second sets of eyes on it. Just to give you a quick story, I completed my undergraduate thesis in 2002. And just a couple of weeks ago, we have these new kittens and they knocked over a shelf. And when I was cleaning up the shelf, I came across my undergraduate thesis and my first instinct was to correct it. So, you know, there's always, I do that with work that I published last year. It's just something that it's a skill to have, but at a certain point, it's time for your paper, the work that you've been doing, to move forward. When I was in graduate school and in the final year writing my thesis, that was really challenging for me to find the time to do this. And I think that we all have our own ideas about what works best for us, but it's also really important to find out what works best for us. And what works best for me might not be what works best for everyone else. But for me, what I did, I'm a morning person. So I would take 4 hours every morning and that's all I would do. I wouldn't check my email. I didn't have my phone on. And the other thing that I had to do before I started writing was reading. And for me, reading a paper before I started writing really got those juices flowing. So that was one strategy that I've used. Another one that I recently shared with my lab, and remember, this is tips on publishing successfully. I've actually never published anything alone. It's funny to state, but it's true. I did, there's one exception. I think I forgot to put my mentor's name on a poster one time. But, you know, it's important to make those mistakes in places where you're really safe. He was very understanding. We had a really nice conversation about it. And I learned a lot from making that mistake. Also, the longer that I hold on to something from my co-authors, from the team that I'm writing it with, the longer it is until that piece is published. So it's really important to just kind of have timelines and move forward. I think it's also important for me to get a second set of eyes on things really quickly, to be transparent with your team or with your co-authors, graduate students, undergraduate students, and like what those expectations are for that research and publishing, and creating plans around that, and then contingency plans around that as well. And acknowledge early when you don't have time. It seems to be a line that I'm using frequently right now, is that I'm overcommitted. And that's just an honest way of sharing with some of my collaborators that while I'm very interested in helping, I don't necessarily have the time in this moment to be the lead author on something, or however I can contribute, but here's what I am able to do, and being really honest around what that is. Okay. A couple other tips. Read the journal guidelines ahead of time. So if you're at a point where you're ready to publish, read the journal guidelines. A recent paper that in preparation for this panel, I went back to take a look at my notes on it. And this is, for me, this is a very, very important paper. I'm excited that we're considering some relatively major journals in our field for this paper. So the journal that we picked is number one. I went in and read their guidelines. This particular paper includes children and animals. I won't get into the specifics on that, but the journal that we were targeting, their guidelines said, based on author guidelines, Pediatrics, this is the name of the journal, does not accept manuscripts that involved animal research. Great. That's not the journal that we're going to go forward with. I now know that. I knew that before I started writing the paper. So that, well, it wasn't a deterrent at all. It was actually really helpful to know that in advance. We moved on to another journal, and going through, I have notes to myself, okay, most papers in this journal appear to be about 11 pages. Great. Now I know what the standard is while I'm putting this information together. So I'm not revising something that's already written. I have those guidelines in advance before I'm getting started. And a couple of other really quick things. It's easy to put publishing and writing on the back burner because, you know, you'll have time for it later. And I would really encourage you to try and make time to do that early on. And also really when you're thinking about things, sort of have these working drafts that are ongoing. And my other final story, I hope I didn't go over in my time here, is what a desk reject is. And last year I had a student who had submitted a publication to a journal and it came back really quickly, like, I don't know, maybe a day or two. And he pulled me aside and he was like, Megan, this paper got rejected really fast. Like, it must be terrible. And I was like, that's great news. And he didn't understand what I meant. What I meant was, I actually think that editor did a great job. That editor took a look at the paper. It didn't meet the mission and vision of their journal, and they sent it back immediately. And that does not mean that your paper is not good. That simply means that that paper isn't the right fit for that journal. And we were able to turn it around and resubmit it somewhere else. It has now been successfully published, but don't be deterred. When things are rejected or when they're rejected really quickly. So, okay. And
I also love desk rejects, both as an editor and as an author, because even though it stinks to get a rejection, like Megan said, you at least know right away rather than waiting 3 months and then finding out, oh, you know, this really wasn't a good fit. Sorry. The tips that I have, I mean, they really do mirror what Megan was saying. Being agentic is important, right? As a student, I cannot stress enough the need for you to pick publications and pursue them on your own. Don't expect your advisor to just give stuff to you. You know, you have to ask, you have to look for data, you have to ask good questions, talk to your advisors about, hey, could this be a publication? Use your courses, like you're taking a statistics course, try to figure out, can you take courses that help you get to a publication? Second is to get out of your own head, right? So Megan said, don't worry about things being imperfect. That's totally true. I actually have a policy of not reading things that I've written, like once it's published, because I'm afraid of what I'm going to see. But that also means, you know, as you're a student and you're learning, realize that this is like Hansel and Gretel, right? You're out in the forest and you're going on this path and you're trying to show people where you've gone and tell people, what's the journey you've taken? What are the highlights? You know, I was here, and then I was here, and I was here. But that means you have to leave breadcrumbs along the way. By the time something that you write gets published, you're a year or 2 years beyond that place. So don't worry about, uh-oh, I learned a new method, or uh-oh, I learned a new theory. I need to just raise my paper and start from the beginning again. Because that's not the way science really progresses, right? It's iterative. It builds on itself. So don't be afraid to drop a breadcrumb and say, hey, this is where I was. You can talk about where you are now later. And then last, we haven't really got a chance to talk about the whole peer review process yet, but it sounds like we're going to talk about that. I would really encourage you to think about who your audience is. And of course, the readership is ultimately the audience you're aiming for, but the readership doesn't determine what gets published. The people who determine it are the editors, the action editors, the peer reviewers. think about the things that those people are going to be interested in. You know, as an editor, when I get papers, I don't have a chance to read every paper that comes to the journal. I read the abstract, I jump to the research questions, skim the methods, read the results, skim the discussion, and based on that, I make a decision. Is this worth sending to an action editor to then field for peer review or not? So if those are the things that your action editors might, or your editors, and I guess actually the action editors also might be looking for, make sure to give sufficient detail in your abstract, right? The abstract is usually what comes last, but it's not a throwaway. It's something that's going to attract attention. Make sure that your research questions are clearly stated and that your methods are clearly aligned with that. Make sure your discussion doesn't go beyond what you actually say, right? It's okay to speculate, but it's not okay to make conclusions that just aren't simply supported. And I see that a lot, actually. Yeah, I guess I'll stop there. And.
And.
That's the sweet spot on the panel.
Well, I can go after everybody else.
We'll mix it up next time.
Yeah. So John said something very important that, you know, usually we don't go back and read what we have already published and already written. And I usually get two kinds of reactions. Sometimes I just can't hold back. I have to go back and read, you know, what came out of my great pen or my great, keyboard nowadays. And I usually get two kinds of reaction. One is, I cannot believe I wrote this. And the other is, I can't believe I wrote that. You know, it's almost like it can be both encouraging at times and discouraging. So I would suggest that if you do write papers and maybe 5 years down the line, you should maybe just take a quick glance. And if you feel like it's giving you a negative feeling, forget about it. Move on to the next one. So now we are in the kind of technical part of looking at, you know, how this whole process plays out. And there could be multiple answers, you know, multiple pathways that you could take in the technical, in this technical piece. And I think that might suit the way you work, your personality, and how you see yourself as a professional and what really work, what strategy works best for you. So my strategy usually has been from my graduate school days is that I am both a vertical thinker and also a horizontal thinker at the same time. Can you imagine how confusing that can be? So as I'm writing or as I'm reading something, I have so many ideas coming out of whatever activity that I'm engaging in at that particular moment that I always keep a separate folder on the desktop called as great ideas. So when you're writing your thesis or your chapter or writing one manuscript and you are right in the middle of these great points that you're making, and if you think like the way I do, you will have multiple streams of consciousness just playing in, you know, in a separate ballpark along with you. Now that can be very distracting because that can pull you away or pull your focus away from what you're doing at that moment. So what you do is you do that parking lot concept where you put everything in the great ideas folder, and then you have subconsciously reassured yourself that you have some memory of that, and you go back to doing your work. So that usually works for me. I'm not sure if it will work for everybody. And again, I said that what has worked for one person may not work for another. I usually tend to think of publishable ideas as, or publishable data or pieces of work as very succinct with well-defined boundaries, very clear ideas, okay? And it's almost a little bit of a repetitive process of what comes first, the journal, the target journal, or the idea. And sometimes maybe they come at the same time, maybe they come close by, and sometimes you have an idea and you're shopping for a journal, and sometimes you have a journal and you're trying to figure out which idea would actually fit into that journal. But whatever it is that you do, whatever John and Megan said, make sure you fully understand what the journal requirements are in terms of putting or submitting a paper for publication. I do, as an editor, I do exactly what John does, is to sometimes look at the article and basically read the abstract and see if it grabs me and then go to the method section, et cetera. Sometimes we just simply reject the paper without doing that because the paper is not written in a format that is prescribed by that journal. So that's what we call as desktop rejection at times. Or sometimes when you have a journal that is not accepting animal-based study results and you have submitted an entire paper based on animal-based, so they get rejected pretty quickly. And I always, so usually editors, when the rejection letter comes, it's a pretty, you know, textbook cookie-cutter kind of letter, but I tend to always write a sentence saying that we are unable to accept this paper at this point because 1, 2, 3. So if it was not formatted accordingly, then I always give them an opportunity to come back and do it. But it is good to do that homework prior to submitting an article rather than the editor telling you, because that doesn't leave a very good impression. I also want to echo the point that don't let perfection be the enemy of the good. Okay? At this very early stage in your career, you're just beginning. So the idea is that if you have something good that's working, that you're working on, don't wait for it to mature, grow old, and probably die. Publish it at the right time. So I think, and again, that's a subjective answer. I don't know what that transition period is between good and perfect. But if you have a reasonably good idea and you're working in collaboration with your peers or your mentor, and if they all agree that this is an idea that you should move forward, don't wait too long in terms of putting forward that idea. Publication in collaboration with others is again and can be a very interesting experience. In the field that I was originally trained in, collaborative publications were seen as kind of a little bit low prestige publications. I don't know, for something really weird. And single author publications were seen as really the maverick academic succeeding, you know, in just uncovering the world. So what we ended up doing, what I ended up doing was writing two ethnographies or two books as a single author. And I can't even begin to tell you how boring that experience was. I did not feel powerful at all. I felt very lonely. I was working on an island. And because I was not going to share authorship with anybody, I felt this sense of ethical, you know, guilt that if I am discussing ideas with people and they are giving me ideas, am I stealing their ideas? So it became a very lonely enterprise. When I started working with people or working in collaboration with other researchers, it is always good to clarify the role delineation. It is always good to clarify how the authorship pieces are going to play out. So you're not surprised at the end while you were thinking that this is kind of your work, and then you find yourself somewhere in the middle of that authorship list. So I think those are some of the technical pieces that, you know, that can be very situational, but it's good to look at those pieces ahead of time. Okay? So I'm going to stop right here. And?
There's no end here. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else I can add. So how do you publish, right? So this is really a hard question because probably the only answer is did a good job, right? So I'm thinking now what doing a good job really means. And I am thinking kind of it may start with kind of having a person who provide great guidance, okay? So I think it's really important to have somebody who has expert content knowledge on the subject you're interested. That's the very starting point because the first step toward the publication is to ask right question, great question, okay? Not kind of me too question, okay? So it's been like 15 years. I was just graduating. I think I was doing postdoc probably. And I went to a conference, economics conference, and the kind of, you know, the speaker, main speaker was Gary Becker. I don't know whether you know him. He's, you know, Nobel economist. And like everybody admire in our field. And he said one thing that I still kind of repeating myself, you know. Don't wait until you really satisfied, you know, your work, your result. But, you know, try to be the first to ask the question and answer the question. That makes difference. So don't be afraid to be rejected with, you know, regarding your publication, but try to get help from content expert to ask the right question that can advance the field or you know, whatever you like to do with the publication. That's, I think the, for me, is like single most important thing, okay? Then I think I'm serving on the editorial board for four different journals. And, you know, oftentimes I singing kind of, you know, can create title. Then I think somebody mentioned that with really, you know, weird format. You know, so just its formatting. And sometimes I feel like, you know, when I'm kind of asked to review it as an edit, you know, kind of, you know, editor, I feel like, okay, this will take probably forever for kind of this person make it right, right? So, you know, if the question is not really great, then I mean, there's no way we can kind of proceed with the manuscript. So just send it back to the authors, okay? So that doesn't mean that you should do a perfect job, you know, following the kind of journal's kind of style or format, but you make sure to write your manuscript as close to, you know, kind of, you know, the journal style that is kind of, you know, more technical kind of tip. And I think another, you know, second most important thing I'm thinking of in terms of publication is to kind of develop your routine, the writing routine. Because as a student, it's really hard to find time to write because you're taking courses or doing TA or GRA, so you're doing work for others, or, you know, so you're left with little time for your own research, advancing your research. So I'm not a morning person, so I remember, you know, in graduate school, I start to write like, you know, 11 p.m. right until 3 a.m. or something. I cannot do that anymore, but it just depends. So, but I think I was really productive during that time. So no matter what I do during the day, I mean, that's my time to really think and write manuscript. So I don't think without that chunk of time, I could be able to advance myself with, you know, kind of learning all the, you know, kind of nuts and bolts of kind of writing, you know, kind of, you know, research, you know, manuscript or things like that. So, you know, so to summarize what I said is to find, you know, content expert who can give you, you know, guidance and work closely with that person, you know, probably your advisor or even not your academic advisor, but someone can advise you with the content knowledge so you can ask great questions. Also find your routine to write your own manuscript.
I agree with actually everything that people said. I took this question a little bit differently because we were posed with how do you publish? And so my response really was 90% of my work is probably published through scientific journals through the peer review process. And I would echo, I love to write, but I absolutely hate every single one of the papers by the time it's published. And I don't reread my work unless I'm forced to. Like, because it takes a boatload of work to go through the scientific publishing process. So those of you who maybe have written, you know, prided yourself on writing a draft of an article and maybe done two or three revisions, by the time you're actually hitting peer review and publishing to that level, 10, 11, 12 versions, 14 or more. Part of that is using your panel, your co-authors in a peer review journal. And this is maybe if I ever saw a peer-reviewed journal with just one name on it, I would reject it as a crackpot, unless it was like a commentary or something that was meant to be a one-person point of view. You don't publish this. You don't. This isn't a singular activity. This isn't something you do in isolation. You have co-authors and you're using them. And those co-authors feed in, and so there's revisions. So build that into your thinking. It takes a lot of time. Usually for me, the quickest I've ever published something from beginning to end is maybe a year. Maybe. That's pretty quick. So it takes time, which is part of the dedication as part of the profession. It will take longer if you do not pay yourself with your own time. Time is the one most valuable thing that we have in life. It's the only thing we don't get back once it's spent. Everything else you can buy back. Your time is your most valuable commodity, and where you spend it reflects what you value the most, whether you've consciously or unconsciously made that decision. You are all here to get PhDs. That does mean writing a dissertation. That means papers, publishing, writing. Give yourself the gift of your own time. It's the one thing that's in your control. And yes, we get pulled in a gajillion different ways every day. Like just today alone, I've been in like, this is the third recorded panel I've done today.
Popular.
It's one of those days. But I and my own group, and this is the first time I've done it, and some of it's to hold myself accountable. We have a writing challenge going on within my own research group where we're all trying to write 2 hours a day, and we're emailing out and being accountable. Because paying yourself first, at least 2 hours a day, to write is the best thing you can do for yourself. It's like eating 5 fruits and vegetables a day or going for a walk. The other advice I would give you with that echoes when you do use your time. We all have time. We all have our own cyclical clocks, right? And there's times where we're more productive and times where we're just dragging. How many of us actually prioritize our prime time for ourselves? It took me a long time to accept that I was giving my best time away to meaningless stuff. And then not having quality time left for myself, for what I needed the most, for my career, for my research, for the things that truly drive me. And I have subsequently flipped that script until days like today where my life is fragmented. And yes, I will be writing probably from 11 to 1 o'clock up. I'm a night owl anyway. But find the time you're most productive and save it for yourself for writing. That's one of the keys. The second key is the blank page is scary. Use an outline. I use outlines as my tool all the time, and I will share my outline early, often, and frequently with my co-authors because it helps align. And then you're just talking about bullet points. You haven't invested your life in paragraphs and words and choices that can take forever. It's just, this is the introduction. This is the idea I'm going to plunk here. This is the progression of the storyline. Here's the hypothesis. Here's my methods. Here's my, the 5 tables that'll come out of this maybe, or maybe 6. I don't know. Workshop that, because every article, actually anything you write, is a story. Doesn't matter if it's a peer-reviewed publication, doesn't matter if it's a journal, doesn't matter if it's a news story, it's a story and it has a story arc. And the best publications tell the story well. So use an outline, because that's an easy way to feedback and get input and buy-in without investing a whole lot of time. And it makes sure everybody on the co-author list is aligned. I would also recommend that for when you're doing your dissertation proposals. Anything that requires a group consensus on your effort, get the buy-in and do it with outlines. The third thing that I wanted to kind of mention on this is I agree that perfection is the antithesis of pretty much everything. And it's a common block. And I think I've succumbed to it as well at times where I don't want to share this. It's not ready. if you also kind of dig into it, perfection is really just the inverse nice way of saying insecurity. So get over it. There is no such thing as perfect. The people that you have around you are there to help you. This is one of the friendliest, nicest, most supportive, collegial environments I have ever, ever, ever seen. Use it. Yeah, use it. And there's an 80-20 rule as well, which is 80% of your time on a paper is going to be just polishing that last 20%. So share your draft with your co-authors, because they will help you chip away at that 20% quicker than you will, because you won't see it again. That's why you trust me, you're going to hate whatever you produce. A lot of it. Doesn't mean it's not good, you know, but it's just use the team. Now, as PhD students, it's your job to drive the project. So you can't just belly flop and say, finish it for me. We won't do that for you. But we will help you answer the questions and make the decisions that are tripping you up.
Let me add just one thing. From my kind of experience with my students, I oftentimes kind of can feel my students really afraid of being kind of, you know, looked stupid. And that's, for me, that's a huge barrier that my students should overcome. So, I mean, you probably always hear that in a classroom, there's no kind of stupid question or things like that. I think it's the same when we advising or we're working with our students. We don't expect them to be like, someone with like IQ of 180, right? So we were all there. So we understand, you know, frustration students may have when they trying this first time. So I think that's the barrier you need to get rid of completely. Don't be afraid. I mean, you know, don't care much about, you know, what others, your advisor think of you. I mean, we could look stupid, right? But we could improve. So just focus on kind of taking advantage of the expert you are working with, you know, your advisor or other faculty members you really like to work with. So use them wisely to do that. Again, just don't be afraid. It's okay to ask stupid question. Then, you know, your faculty and a mentor will help you to ask right question.
I think that's a good place to open it up for questions, sure. And you can ask stupid questions. What we should do is speak clearly and loudly, and then the faculty will repeat your question so it gets copied in our video. So, who asks questions?
I have a question.
You go.
Thank you so much, panelists. Barbara Henley. I'm a PhD student in environmental occupational health, and Molly is my advisor. And I felt like that last part she was speaking directly to me, because I have been stuck in the polishing the turd phase, I guess.
We're a little blunt in my group.
Current editors that are on the panel, and then also anyone else who has insight and would like to share, what are the biggest mistakes that first-time or early career authors make in your field?
Okay, so the question was, what are the biggest mistakes that first-time or early career authors make in the field or in our respective fields? I mean, I think that Sunil's already said this, it's making sure that you follow the guidelines. Make sure that the journal is a correct outlet for what you're trying to publish, because you may see some journal cited lots and lots and lots, and you know it's like the flagship journal of a society, and you go to that society's biennial meeting every 2 years, and so this must be where I want to publish. And that's not right. You want to make sure there's a good fit between what you've written and where it goes.
Yeah, I think that's very important. The second thing that I have noticed, sometimes the too many ideas packed in one. And that's really kind of a very, almost like a litmus test of an early, or maybe a first writer or a graduate student deciding to just be Paul Bunyan on their own and just do their own thing. So too many ideas packed in one, the paper, it's very prescriptive with the journal, the usual, you know, the typical length of the paper, what it should be, 6,000 words, 8,000 words, whatever it is. You got 4,000 to 6,000, and you got like 20,000, and you got 15,000. And then if you say, well, please follow the journal guidelines without being too prescriptive, then it come back with 12,000. So you begin to develop that, you know. I mean, so obviously, this person is not taking the time to read. Either they are too fascinated with their idea, or they see perfect alignment between their idea and the journal. So those are the rookie mistakes that people make. Another mistake that I mean, I don't want to just focus just on the rookies, because some authors do tend to make that mistake. They often don't fully read the time it takes for the peer review process to be completed. At times, I find authors not really reading what the peer review process entails. And this may change from journal to journal, but usually, you know, it takes a long time. As Molly said, you know, the fastest she published, and she's a voracious publisher in terms of, you know, the articles that she's published and the number of papers that she's published. If it took her about a year, so you can imagine what the peer review process would have taken. I'm just guessing here. So what happens is a lot of authors, they send their papers in, and we acknowledge that the paper is good enough to go through the peer review process. And after every 15 days, they send an email asking about an update on the status of their manuscript. So usually a short of single malt calms me down, but what typically ends up happening is that, you know, after some time, you just give up and you say, well, unfortunately, we have not been able to complete the peer review process, so we would like to allow you to withdraw your paper. That's, again, so I'm getting a little bit too technical, but that's, again, a rookie mistake that people make sometimes. Do you want to add?
No, you got it.
Okay.
So sometimes I read student term paper, submit it to a journal, a peer review journal. So you know what I'm saying? So it really not polished. So it needs more work, but you know, they kind of probably in rush, you know, submitting it to publish. And if that happens, then, you know, whatever the results are, it's kind of hard to proceed with that paper. In other cases, I mean, so I can tell, you know, students are submitting this from the language they are using, you know, like describing method or describing result. It's like really student style. So sometimes even with, you know, kind of names as the author who we could recognize, meaning that their mentors probably didn't have time to read it, you know, really carefully. So make sure that, you know, whoever, you know, kind of quoting the paper, that they contribute, you know, in a meaningful way, okay? And, you know, so you know, sometimes, the other times, we can tell because it's the paper not really asking, I think I keep repeating, not really good question. Then, I mean, we can easily tell, I mean, it's just meet a question, you know, students writing probably as a kind of part of their course requirement and submitting. So make sure to work closely with your kind of content knowledge expert. Also, methodology important. Then, you know, work with methodologists really closely to kind of really sounds like really professional a manuscript, okay, rather than student manuscript. And I think that will kind of, you know, increase the chance of being published.
No, I would add to that. I think the most rookie mistake is you try to get too much in a manuscript. And this is a little bit different than the dissertations that you guys are going to write, which might be a little bit bigger and are expected to have more literature review. A manuscript is 3,000 to 5,000 words, and there's plenty of publications showing that have analyzed what gets things published quicker. Shorter is better. So it goes back to the old Proust statement, forgive me, my dear friend, for the long letter, for I did not have time to write a short one. It's harder to write concisely than it is to be verbose. And that's the editing, the triage process. That's why you go through revisions and revisions. And my final version, you know, like my final thing that I do on a paper is I stop reading it for its entirety and I just read word for word for word, sentence by sentence by sentence, seeing if I can say it any shorter. And that's my final edit. And it's actually kind of fun. And usually I can squeeze off, you know, 500, 600, 700 words just by going, oh, I don't, you know, there's a lot of extra words that we use. Anyway, that's just one tip to it. One story, though, 3,000, 5,000 words, you can tell one story. So a lot of people try to trip it up and put more and more and more in it. Well, when you start getting more than one idea with maybe two subclauses, congratulations, you have two manuscripts. You know, like, it's one idea told well.
I agree, although there's some variation by discipline.
That's true.
So you should, you know.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I routinely get manuscripts that are 30, 35 pages submitted to the journal. We do encourage at least trimming it down to like 30, but it's not uncommon to see some journals, at least in my field, or in psychology, which is where I was trained, to get up into 30, 40. I have one paper that's 50, it was 50 pages double-spaced.
Double-spaced, right?
It was double-spaced, yeah. But there was, yeah. It was a lot of technical detail that the reviewers wanted more and more and more of. And so, like Jungo said, I would love to write 3,000 word papers.
That's why I apparently would be so
overwhelmed. Well, I hope it's a quick comment. I am an associate editor at one journal, but I have a very distinct memory of the first paper that I published. When I got the revisions back, which were very lengthy, I remember thinking, they don't know what they're talking about. Right. And then having to respond. And this particular journal had, like, you know, you were allowed to revise it twice. And then if the second revision wasn't accepted, it was over. And I was on like the fourth revision with this journal or something. So I had already surpassed their maximum. And I'm like, oh, they're trying to help me. So, you know, remember that, like, the editors know when it's your first time.
And I think I just have a follow-up comment because there are such incisive, you know, comments here. So another rookie mistake that I have seen with regard to the journal that I edit is that usually when you submit a paper, it goes through the peer review process. There are three most likely outcomes: revise and resubmit, minor revision, major revision, or reject. Okay. What happens is typically with rookies, when it said revise and resubmit major revisions, they don't revise and resubmit. They get dejected. They get angry. They get the ego begins to play out this. So that's another mistake, that they are taking comments very personally. And so that seasoned researchers, they always say, well, thank you very much for your review comments. It helps us improve the paper and things like that. But rookies usually don't come back, or if they come back, it's a very curt, very angry response, you know, taking it very personally.
Rebecca, you have. I was going to be off of that, of like a rejection or a resubmit that's major edits. Like, how do you, I feel like it kind of causes a writer's block almost. And is there any tips you have for us of, like, getting a rejection and to keep going, or if you get a revise, resubmit, that's major, not to just feel dejected and not necessarily angry, but, like, where you're just like, imposter syndrome, like, I am stupid, and, you know, how do you get past that?
Yeah.
What is your
strategies or tips for us to overcome that?
I think that's an excellent question. So the question is that how do you handle revise and resubmit or the emotional, you know, baggage that is associated with revise and resubmit or the emotional consequences of total rejection? So I'll just share how I manage that. You know, we do get revise and resubmit, and we do get rejection. And the way I handle it, and it's, again, it works for me, may not work for others. I take it very personally. I actually get angry. And I open a Word document, and I just vent out whatever I am feeling at that time, you know. I even try, so I let my emotions run loose and crazy, and I even try to read in between if there was an enemy out there in the academic world who is making sure, I mean, that all these pieces, all the stars were aligned and the paper went to exactly the same person who had an opposite view to what I was proposing here. So I let that happen. I don't repress this. I don't suppress it because it begins to come back, you know, like Hydra, you know. So what I end up doing is I actually let it out in an empty blank document. So 24, 48 hours later, I go back and I look at that document. I just laugh. You know, it almost becomes like a comical exercise. I'm just telling you the strategy that works for me, you know. So usually what happens is then by that time I have emotionally graduated to a level where I can see the comments as being helpful. Yeah. Okay. Then I put myself in that mental state where I begin to look at comments in a positive way. And often if I'm working with my other collaborators, we end up having kind of a mutual counseling session as to how do we strategize, how do we emotionally counsel each other, and then how do we strategize moving forward. And those conversations are very helpful. And I always revise and resubmit. And although I don't like writing it, but my first sentence, as I respond to every reviewer comment, my first sentence is, thank you so much. While I'm saying, you have no idea what you're talking about, but I don't write that, okay? So that's how I respond to it. And frankly, rejection is part of dealing with rejection is part of the academic rites of passage. So get with it. You know, deal with it. That's how it works. Who wants to?
Molly?
I'll follow up on that one. Just a little bit about dealing with rejection. I absolutely agree with Sunil. You got to get it out. Let it out however it is. Because I think I've published about 100 papers now, and I've only had one that was ever accepted without revision. Wow. So that's like a unicorn. The rest of them, you know, one. I have one. I know, one. There was one. The unicorns exist. It is always revise and resubmit. And so you got to just, if you want to publish, you got to just understand that there's a revise and resubmit. That being said, the emotions are real. And if you don't deal with that emotional energy, it will manifest itself in different ways. So I don't, I would love to. You should compile a book of those.
I usually delete that.
It would be kind of funny. I read it, you know, it's like class reviews, and there's just so much rejection and judgment in higher education. It's ridiculous. Every day is full of judgment. I read it, get angry, slam shut the file, and forget about it for a day. And but you have 2 weeks to revise and resubmit, so you got it. You give yourself a day. Then I pull it back up, and I just, because it's usually, hopefully the review's in such a way that it's sort of almost organized into bullet forms. So I just take the bullet, and I just make an outline. And it lays out. And then you also have your co-authors. So, because some of the revision, you're like, oh, I'm not quite sure what they're asking for. I thought I did the best I could. You know, I don't know what to do with this. Fortunately, you have these co-authors. And so those are the ones where you kind of go through and you're like, okay, I can answer that. Clarification. Most 90% of it's clarification. Occasionally it's like revise the model, you know, blah, blah, blah. You realize all of a sudden you can deal with about 80% of it on your own, but there's about 20% of that in there that you need help with. And it's legit help. But now you know exactly what questions to ask. And then that, I pulled together meetings with my co-authors and or through email or whatever. It's like, not sure what they're asking here. What do you think? You know, and you figure it out. And then you not only have the outline of the revision, the letter to, of response, because every time you resubmit, you the reviewer, the editor is going to ask for respond on a point-by-point basis. So you have to create the letter document anyway. So you already have done that. You've also isolated the parts that you need help with, and then you just kind of chip away at the rest of it, and you drop back and forth between versions. And lo and behold, by the time you're done with it, it usually is a better product.
I'm still learning about other discipline, but at least in our discipline of social science, there's no such a thing as minor revision at the first round of review. We always get major revision. For instance, you know, sometimes I get like really 5 minor revision, like, you know, typo or something like that. But it came to me as major revision. So, I mean, there's rule, you know, each discipline has, but major revision doesn't mean that you did really bad job or something like that. It just meaning that, you know, take it seriously. Okay. So, you know, personally, I also always, first round, always major revision. So that the authors take it really seriously. Yeah. So, I mean, I had unicorn once, mm-hmm. only once, but I'm never getting back to the journal again. Yeah, there's a reason. So I learned later, but you know, it rarely happens. Probably don't happen to most people, and it's not necessarily a good thing that you have, right? So
it does sometimes indicate the quality of the journal.
Yeah. So you know, you shouldn't really. You know, shouldn't be afraid of being rejected. And, you know, very recent kind of, you know, example that I have with my co-authors, I'm not the lead author, but second author, that the paper is rejected. So we got together and we went over the reviewers' comments and they really didn't understand the method. So probably they are clinicians, so something like that. So what are you doing? We're writing the editor, really politely writing, okay? We kind of respectfully, you know, requesting you to reconsider your decision to reject our paper for such and such a reason. And, you know, sometimes when, you know, when your papers, your work being rejected for no reason, okay, no good reason, then, I mean, you can always go back to the editorial board to ask for kind of, you know, kind of rewarding their consideration. So, I mean, that's possible. But most people just move on, right? I do usually, so.
I was also going to say the same thing. Lately, I've been getting a lot of reject and major revision. And then when I finally open it up and look, I'm like, this isn't a major revision. So, but my strategy is a little opposite of, Sunil and Molly, I actually don't have a reading pane on my email, and that's very purposeful. I turn it off, and when I get those emails that come in, most of the time my response to myself is, like, I can't handle this right now. I'm not ready for rejection, because that's what it always is, the first round, and then sometimes there's a second or third or more. And so that's one way that I do it. And then, you can't hold it off forever, but then you have to know the journal when you have to have that revision back in by. But like I said, they're coming back, and actually when I first read it, it says rejected major revision, and then I have another eye-rolling moment. But then I go in and look, I'm like, no problem, I've got this. And they also tend to come in for me on Fridays and weekends. So just putting it out there that that's often when editors are doing this type of work. So just be prepared for what works for you with that. So that's what works for me.
Now, the one thing I definitely want to add about rejections I have seen too many times where maybe I've seen a paper twice at different journals where it goes to one journal, it's rejected, but there's ample feedback. And the authors don't respond to that feedback to the next journal, and the paper doesn't do well again. So if you get rejected, take the feedback seriously. And then the second thing I wanted to note is, rather than seeing a major revision as there's a lot wrong with this, see it as the editor wants to publish my work.
Yeah.
And here's a roadmap for how I can get from where I'm at now to this being published. And I like to publish, so I'm going to do this.
That is so positive psychology right there.
Yeah.
You must have a psychologist.
It's true. I mean, you don't do a revised resubmit if you don't want to publish the paper eventually. You know, with some revisions and some massaging.
That's awesome. We did that for you.
As you can see, this is a very important topic that's very, very close to our hearts, and we're talking about personal experiences here. So we could go on and on talking about more rejection stories, but if you have other questions.
I have never published. I'm Tiara. I'm a first-year PhD student. I want to get after it, obviously. I know that I need to. So my question would be, where were you in your education or in your career when you did your first publication, and what was the catalyst that convinced you to go for it with that specific paper?
Oh, nice. That's an excellent question. So my first publication, I remember it, and I agree it gave you the thrill, and I think I told everybody from, like, the lunch lady that checked me out, like, I just got published, all the way through for the day. It was my first dissertation chapter. So we have, I know there's different dissertation styles and different units have different things, but where I came from and what I encourage in my group is the three manuscript style of a dissertation. So my first one was the first chapter of my dissertation. And that's in my whole cohort, that's quite normal.
So the first paper for my dissertation, I got it published after 6 years after I graduated. So my case is a little bit, you know, abnormal, but I, you know, have really hard time publishing anything out of my dissertation, not because of the quality, but because of the kind of standard the field has, you know, like Chicago economists or Harvard economists, that kind of thing. So I really kind of had the trouble persuading kind of, you know, conventional neoclassical economic model perspective, things like that. But I have been working on other things, and I feel like I need to prove myself, actually, personally, prove myself that I'm capable. So I worked on other things and, you know, started publishing with my co-authors. And the first publication as the first author, I worked with my colleague, epidemiologist colleague, who just graduated, you know, from PhD program. So we kind of, you know, young two guys and worked on the same thing and really published in a kind of important journal. And I think I missed this opportunity to tell you, my recommendation, you know, when you try first time, I think you should set your goal really high. So we know how to pick the journal. I really spend any time kind of learning that technique, but I know which journals I'm reading, you know, usually, and, you know, what journals are considered premier. So I kind of picked the kind of best journal and start from there, of course, being rejected several times in a row. But review process teach me really valuable lessons. And being rejected initially is okay. But, you know, if you don't really figure out how to get in, you know, those fields, so, you know, like, you know, people of expert, who, you know, self-claimed expert, you know, if you, you know, being a student is really good time to learn, you know, how to get in there. So I would recommend, you know, set your goal high and try to publish there and being rejected and learn the lessons from it.
That's actually a great question. I started my academic training in a discipline in human genetics where we rarely published individual papers. So I was part of a group of researchers that were working on a very rare congenital malformation. And my role in the very first paper that had my name among many authors was to basically analyze the data and develop a draft of what the paper would look like. And it was published in a very high-ranking journal called Human Genetics. So I was just, I didn't think that was my paper, but it was sure nice to see my name on it. And so for me, as I mentioned, that was a very inspiring moment. And that created almost like a passion in me to find additional opportunities to publish. So I continued to publish with that group for a very long time. And then I changed my academic focus and moved into a discipline where you were the solitary researcher working on your own in your own world. And that's when I became an anthropologist. And it was very hard to transition from a group writing system to being alone and writing by yourself. But I think that inspiration carried on with me, and I ended up publishing my first solo paper in a journal called Social Science and Medicine. And did that create like a lot of ego boost inside? And I just ended up, I said, like, I was the best thing that could have hit the planet after that. And eventually, when 4 or 5 rejections came immediately after that, I was like, okay, we're normal human beings. So that's my story. And the reason I'm saying this is because you should publish. If you get an opportunity, you should publish either as individuals or as part of your team, because you will soon find out, as I found out, that it has this very, very positive snowball effect. Okay, so don't get rejected just because you received a, you know, revise or resubmit or reject, you know, improve your ideas and keep going at it. Okay.
And so my initial publication story follows more of Sunil's pre-anthropology, where I don't really think that I ever had this great moment of my first real publication. I was, you know, an et al. Author on papers as a graduate student, then my master's thesis. So just for background, in psychology, we had just a 5-year program. First 2 years were master's, then the last 3 years were PhD. So I got my master's thesis my second year, tried to publish that, it didn't go anywhere. Third year was comps, but fourth year I had off. And so that was the first year that I had to really have time to write a first author paper. But by the point that I had gotten there, I was already on other papers. I had first authored. First off, it was like an invited chapter where my advisor was invited. And then I just kind of got to take over it. And then it was a peer-reviewed chapter. And that was pretty cool because it was peer-reviewed, but it's still a book chapter. And so I think it was just more of an acclimation process for me than a, I got it.
Yeah, I think mine was pretty similar to that too. I was just thinking back which paper was published first, but I actually took over a paper that my graduate student colleague had started, and she had moved on to another institution and was doing great things. And this paper still existed and needed work and help. And so I kind of took it on and helped her finish it. It was my grad student colleagues though that really helped me make those first publications. And they're still, you know, we've been out for a while and I still check in with them and we talk about those times. And we influenced each other at that time too in respect to our publications and leveraged our respective strengths. And that's really what helped us kind of in addition to our mentor. I don't have a memory. I do remember though, that my first publication, well, in my mind, it was published because it was in press. So that's very common with journals, is that something's in press. It took forever. Like, I think it was, it took forever to actually have a hard copy publication. So make sure that you're putting those in press publications also on your CV to recognize that. Mm-hmm.
So I'm watching our time. So I think that we've got time for one more question.
So behind you, right?
There's a question here.
Yeah.
So my question is sort of on the very tail end of the publication process, especially now when it seems to me there's just the volume of academic publishing has proliferated so much. what, if anything, do you do once your manuscripts are published to promote or disseminate them beyond that? Or do you just expect that research, other people will find them on their own?
We should send you over to our marketing and communications team. However, actually, as faculty at OSU, that is a resource that we have. So we will work with marketing and communications internally within our college, but also at the university, and they will help us get information out. I don't tweet, but I think you do. So maybe you can help.
So I think the game has changed a little bit. Sometimes your journals will help you publicize it and tweet and stuff on your behalf. Sometimes the university will pick up and write a press release for you. And when they do that, it's awesome because you hate your baby, but they will they will make it look like a cute baby again. And they can just talk about it in a different way, but they won't pick up every press release. So I really only now promote the ones that they'll pick up a press release on. But then I send it out by Twitter, especially because a lot of my students are publishing and I want to get them out there in the world. So I use it as a way to try to use my profile to raise their profile. And that's easy enough to do with Twitter or social media feeds. And then if you get a press release, it just gets picked up. So like Stephanie Foster, one of my MPH students, very unusually was able to get a publication out of her internship with the EPA. And that got picked up as a press release and hit the national news. And it was in a really good journal. And all of her co-authors are like, Steph, this isn't going to get, this won't happen again like this. Not every paper is a national story. So I think that's part of it too. Every paper is a different experience. And you're going to face different challenges with every paper. But that being said, the process is the same. And it is, you have to first write it. Then you have to figure out what journal it is. And I agree. I kind of reverse engineer always my papers. Where am I going to send it? And then I'll write it to that style. Except that there's going to be a dozen revisions on it before it even goes out the door, because a well-written paper is less likely to be rejected. Figure out how to deal with the stress of rejection, because that's real. They give you timelines, so it's about good time management. Figure out the pattern of writing papers, because the formula is there for all of our disciplines have a specific formula for how you tell the story. And the easiest way, I think, to get rejected is to not follow the formula. So talk to people and learn the formula. And then it's just wash, rinse, repeat, wash, rinse, repeat, wash, rinse, repeat.
Great advice. I also take advantage of all the social media stuff that's out there. It's so interesting that that Twitter has become a very interesting medium to publicize your work. There is now ResearchGate, which is a community of scholars. You can always create a profile, or LinkedIn. You can create a profile over there. You can update your publications. And sometimes it can be overwhelming, because they will then send you an email if somebody has cited your work, which of course we love to receive. But then what happens is they also send you emails where they tell you that the person you cited has published another paper. And that sometimes invokes a feeling of jealousy at times. So I think ResearchGate and LinkedIn are kind of other mechanisms that I would say to publicize your own result. Or own research. I think, as Megan said, we are very fortunate that we are at an institution where the institution takes responsibility for it. And frankly, I will be remiss if I didn't tell you that I sneak into my computer every once a week to see who has cited my papers. And if they have not, and they're working on a topic, I usually send them my references.
I think good. Yeah.